States are competing to get personal protective equipment, which has been in short supply for healthcare workers.
She got in her car and she sped as fast she could down I-55 and met the vendor at a McDonald's parking lot.
We'll hear from Illinois Comptroller Susana Mendoza, whose office writes the checks. We'll also have a conversation about the damage COVID-19 is doing to the state's finances. Plus, even though the stay-at-home order has shut down many businesses, the need for everyday services like haircuts doesn't stop. Today, we'll hear from stylists and a salon owner about trying to navigate the crisis. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up this hour on The 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media that airs on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ DeKalb. The news is next. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As we go to air Wednesday morning, the Illinois Department of Public Health has announced another 1,200 newly confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Illinois, plus 74 more deaths. Sad as those figures are, they do suggest that Illinois' business closures and stay-at-home orders seem to be working to slow the exponential rate at which coronavirus disease spreads. Instead of cases doubling every 2 days, as they were in late March, they're now doubling every 8 days. Today on the 21st, we'll have more on those business closures as they relate to hair salons. That's later in the show. But first, two conversations about Illinois state finances. Susana Mendoza has been the comptroller of Illinois since winning a special election in 2016. Her office is responsible for managing state government's day-to-day spending, which has led to some unusual adventures in an era when states are competing for masks, ventilators, and other medical supplies. Comptroller Mendoza, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
So let's begin by talking about procurement. This is not a topic that I think usually quickens the pulse, for most people anyway, but it's gotten exciting enough that you were invited on CNN last week. Can you tell me what is the story that has gotten so much attention for the way Illinois goes about purchasing goods and services?
Sure. So that was an interesting story, given just the new reality of what it is to procure goods in the state of Illinois during the COVID-19 pandemic. We found ourselves in a mad rush to secure PPE for our doctors, nurses, frontline providers, and unfortunately found ourselves in somewhat of what felt like the Wild Wild West, a black market type scenario where we were competing against other states with incredibly short time frames in which we had to act and get funds released to procure these goods. And, it was just a crazy situation. There was one scenario that obviously got a lot of attention where we thought we were going to lose a contract for 1.5 million masks. And the reason we thought we were going to lose it is because the day that the check was being issued to the vendor notified us that if he did not receive the check in his bank account by 2 p.m. that day, which he was in one of the suburbs of Chicago, and the check is physically being written in Springfield. If he didn't receive it before that 2 o'clock deadline, that we would lose that purchase of 1.5 million masks to a different state, a different buyer. And we really, for a split second, thought, oh my gosh, we're going to lose these masks, which are so critically important. Remember, this is in the very early days where it was just a mad rush to get your hands on PPE. And one of my assistant controllers, who is physically located in Springfield, said, no way are we going to lose this. And that was Ellen Andrus. And she said, I'll drive the check over to this guy if I need to. And so she got in her car and she sped as fast she could down I-55 and met the vendor about 126 miles out of Springfield in Dwight, at a McDonald's parking lot, verified that this was in fact the person who we did the deal with, and then handed off a $3.5 million check for these masks and other necessary critical PPE to be procured. I mean, really, the thought of that story being a real factual thing that occurred just seems so out of the realm of anyone's craziest imagination, but that's essentially where we're at as a state today.
I would say she didn't have to like take possession of the masks in her trunk at the McDonald's or anything, right?
No. The story kind of sounds like that, but no. But she just had to make sure that the check got into the bank. And the only way to do that was for her to meet the guy more than halfway down, because he would have never been able to make it to Springfield and back to get the check in on time. But, you know, you're just, again, thinking outside of the box with like a nanosecond to get it right. And my staff is amazing. Ellen Andrus, you know, got the job done that day for the folks on the front lines. And 2 days later, Cortez Gillespie, another one of my employees in Springfield, did the same thing. He had a little bit more of a window of time, so he didn't have to break too many speeding rules. But nonetheless, also took a $3 million plus check and hand delivered it at a Road Ranger gas station on the side of the road, many miles, over 100 miles away from Springfield again. So these are just crazy situations, obviously completely out of the norm, which is why they've drawn the attention of, you know, folks like CNN and other national news networks.
So you've begun tracking how much Illinois spends on purchases related to its COVID-19 response. Where are we on that right now?
So as of today, we've spent $174 million specifically on purchases related to PPE, right? COVID-19 related spending. And we thought it was important for the sake of transparency that taxpayers know where their money is going. And we started our first point of this is on March 24th. And you'll see, for example, on March 24th, we spent $5 million. The next day, that had gone up to $24 million. And it just keeps going up and up and up. And some days the activity is more than others. But the worst part about this is that this $174 million is money that we had not planned for in the budget, right? These are expedited payments that we never envisioned having to make, which means $174 million less than what we had planned for. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. We are very likely going to be spending significantly more dollars than the $174 that's been physically issued as of today.
So we've been kind of talking about, you know, the role of the controller. And I know that before I began covering state government as a reporter many years ago, I didn't really understand what the controller does. So just briefly, can you help people, remind people what it is that the controller's office is responsible for in Illinois government?
Sure. So the controller is the state's chief fiscal officer. My job is to manage the state's fiscal accounts. The role is typically one that people, if they actually even know what a controller does, they assume it's just a person who writes the checks, right? Pays the state's bills. But clearly, in Illinois, the controller's office, I think, has a much different, more outsized role than perhaps other controllers in other states. Primarily given that over the last, I've been controller for now 3 years, but two of those 3 years, we were in the middle of a horrible budget crisis. My first 2 years as controller, I took office right in the middle of the worst fiscal crisis in the history of the state of Illinois. We're used to dealing with crisis. We're prepared to deal with crisis. We know how to get through it and, more importantly, get out of it. And this is just one more crisis that we will get through. It is expensive, though, when you think about, when we talk about the PPE expenditures, you know, the $174 is many times more than what we should have paid for that PPE, given that we were essentially thrown into a black market situation and having to compete against other states and therefore driving the price of each one of those masks or bottles of hand sanitizer through the roof.
So this conversation is airing on what would have been tax day, but of course, state and federal tax deadlines have been delayed. And do you have a sense of what the fact that income tax receipts into Illinois might be significantly less? I mean, we've in past years recently, we've talked about the April surprise where tax revenues exceeded expectations. Do you have a sense yet of what we are potentially facing going forward with this year and the recession we're in?
Well, it's too early to give you a number, but clearly we will see significantly less revenues come in July than we had originally anticipated. I mean, it's just common sense that when you have 10% of the workforce across the country stop working, and you know, similar numbers here in Illinois, that is going to have an immediate impact on the revenues that we're collecting as a state. Furthermore, the fact that we don't have any revenues to report, like the significant influx of revenues that we normally get in April, which is the tax month, help us to catch up with some of the bill backlog, help us to catch up with some of these more critical payments, and even get ahead on in other areas where, you know, we want to put money in so that we don't have to really scramble 2-3 months down the road. We're not able to do any of that, and we don't know what the actual significance of this delay will be until we get to July with the new deadline being for income tax filing. So in July, we'll have a better opportunity to talk about raw numbers and how bad of a hit this was to us in terms of tax revenues coming in. But that will be the immediate July report. We'll deal with this tax year filing. But it's not still going to tell us where we're going to be for the next few months. And that's really going to be a combination of things. It's how bad of a hit did we take in our normal tax revenue year? How bad of a hit did we take with the loss of people during the height of the stay-at-home orders? How soon those stay-at-home orders get lifted, or how they get lifted, how they get rolled back into the marketplace, will also have significant impact on our revenue projections. So again, it's too early to tell numbers, but without a doubt, it is going to hurt and it will be painful.
So what Illinois does not, as you well know, does not have a rainy days fund to speak of. I mean, there is a fund, but there's, I think you've said that there's about 30 seconds, enough money to fund government for about 30 seconds in it. So one of the ways the state does manage its finances, one of the ways you manage the finances, is choosing who gets paid and when in terms of paying the state's bills. And we've seen the backlog of bills creeping up. It was a little below $6 billion in October of last year. In early March, it was below $7 billion. Then earlier this week, it was up above $8 billion. How are you prioritizing who gets paid and when?
Right. That's a great question. So I should say right now, we're in the middle of prioritizing COVID-19 coronavirus. So anything dealing with that and the frontline effort to combat this is going to be our most immediate priority. Knowing that, it still means that we have additional priorities of funding. So, for example, healthcare, debt service, state payrolls, K-12 general state aid funding, right, our required pension payments by law. Those will continue to be made, and we're going to make sure that the state's most vulnerable citizens, urgent needs, those things that they need more than anything, will continue to be served. But I think the most important thing that we can do right now is to assure the vendor and the provider community that, like in the past, we will eventually catch up and we will be making our payments to them as quickly as possible. Just right now, our priorities have to shift to COVID-19, debt service, healthcare, education, state payrolls, and required pension payments.
Do you have a sense yet as to how high the backlog will get and when?
Not yet, but we are closely monitoring that. You can see it's been, you know, ticking up. What I can assure you is that, you know, this last year's budget did not give us significant tools to chip away at the bill backlog. We're still utilizing existing tools that are in our arsenal, like interfund borrowing and short-term borrowing. But, you know, I've tried to be very, very good about only utilizing short-term borrowing where it will actually save us money, so that we tackle those bills that are accruing 12% interest, for example, and pay a much lower interest rate. But you know, again, this is uncharted territory for any state. It was tough to navigate this fiscal crisis in the past. It's going to be harder to do so moving forward. But like I said, our office is experienced when it comes to dealing with crisis, and we will be prepared to step up to the challenge. I'm not as much concerned about navigating the fiscal waters here as I'm concerned about the emotional toll and the death toll that this COVID-19 pandemic has brought upon our state and on our country as a whole. We can get the finances put in check. I think that the governor will fight for every dollar that he can get from federal funds. You know, I know that he and other governors have requested additional aid from the federal government to states that have been impacted in a large way by COVID. And I would assume that we're going to need more dollars than what has initially been promised to us, or that assurance that we're going to be getting from CARES Act. But my job is going to do to try to make the best is going to be to try to make the best use of every single federal match that we can get, and prioritize the bills in a way that gives us, you know, the biggest bang for that federal buck that we may be getting down the road.
Last thing I want to ask you about, I know I'm hosting a live radio program now from my house, and I have two young children who I kind of live in mortal fear that they're going to burst in at any moment during one of these conversations. How have you adapted to the stay-at-home orders and running a state agency at this really surreal time that we're all living through?
Yeah, it sure is. I think that most of my employees, including myself, will be very happy to get back to work once that day arrives and actually see other people and not have to worry about your kids barging in on you. Or in my case, I've done like four interviews today, and in one of them, my husband came down to make a sandwich for our 7-year-old son, and right in the middle of my interview, and it did throw me off a little bit, right? And the worst part was in my last interview, my mom, she lives with us. She lives downstairs, and she has a blue and gold macaw. If anybody knows, that's a huge bird. And for no reason, I don't know, it just started squawking at its highest level. It kind of sounded like someone was being killed or tortured in my house in the middle of my Skype or Zoom interview. So it's hard to stay focused when you have things like that happening. It's also, though, it was funny because he started squawking and I said, the bird's upset. But I mean, who wouldn't be upset in today's day and age, you know? So you have to try to improvise and just roll with the punches. But it's hard to focus when you've got other things that are happening in your surroundings. But it's kind of the beast that we're dealt with right now, right? Everybody is having to figure out new ways to deal with a very unique and stressful situation. But we're going to be happy to get back to some semblance of normalcy, hopefully not too far distant in the future.
Susana Mendoza is the Comptroller of Illinois. Comptroller Mendoza, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. And you hang in there, all right? We're going to get out of this.
All right. Thanks. You too. More to come on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Every day we hear about the human toll of COVID-19, but as we just heard in our conversation with Illinois Comptroller Susana Mendoza, the novel coronavirus is also doing significant damage to the state's finances. Officials have been unable or unwilling to say just how bad the losses in sales and income tax have been, so a group of experts made their own assessment of the damage, or at least the range of possibilities of damage, which seem to span from bad to worse. The report is from the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. We're joined by one of the co-authors, Amanda Cass. She's Associate Director of the Government Finance Research Center at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And also with us is the new director of the Institute, Robin Fretwell Wilson. Robin, Amanda, welcome back to the 21st.
Well, thanks for having us.
Robin, I wanted to begin with you, just sort of a big picture here. What is the Institute of Government and Public Affairs trying to bring to the conversation in Illinois here? What are the big picture questions you're trying to answer as everyone is adapting to this new pandemic reality we find ourselves in?
Well, I think that is a really important question because we've seen such a shift, dramatic shift in our lives, as we say, and something that we were preparing for release in the coming weeks. You know, there's almost no one alive in America, unless they lived through the Great Depression, that have had any kind of experience with this kind of shift and dramatic change in our lives. What we're trying to bring to the table is really to marshal the talents of the faculty across the three University of Illinois system universities and bring it to bear on making people's lives better and, you know, helping people who were fragile coming in to the pandemic to be able to emerge as unscathed as possible. And essentially, President Colleen asked IGPA to assemble a task force. We, at last count, had 55 faculty across the three universities all pulling together, including amazing people like Amanda. So it's been a real privilege to get to work with them. And they are preparing impact reports in three domains. One is the one that Amanda will be talking about, economic and fiscal impacts. A second is on the impact on our healthcare workforce, which is effectively, you know, our frontline responders in this crisis for all of us. And so we have to think about how do we take care of them. And then the third is really one that I'm very passionate about, which is vulnerability. So many people are vulnerable either to the virus or they're vulnerable to the economic fallout from the way we're managing this. Or they have the double whammy, Brian, so that they actually have overlapping vulnerabilities that make them especially, I think, important in the way that we think about how we're managing this, because we need to do right by everyone, but especially those who have the least.
So the first report that came out is the one on the economic and fiscal effects on Illinois. So Amanda, you were one of the co-authors of that report. I wanted to begin by asking you, what is your baseline? How were Illinois government finances doing before the COVID-19 pandemic?
Sure, I think, and that's a kind of great place to start. Some important context, I think, is that the state's finances were doing okay. I think the state was starting to right its fiscal ship. People should keep in mind that the state had fairly recently gone through the period where there's the budget impasse and we had no budget, and we built up a substantial backlog of unpaid bills that accrued interest, and there was a lot of damage done to various parts of the state budget, especially human services. So I think, you know, the state was starting to dig itself out of that and starting to get on solid fiscal footing. And then we had the COVID-19 pandemic occur.
So I wonder, as you're looking at putting together this report, you and your co-authors, there's so much bad economic news out there, to say nothing of the terrible health news as well, that I think it's hard for people to get a grip on it. So how do you begin to quantify it? What numbers do you focus on? How do you do this analysis?
Sure. And I think that's a really good point, is that there's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of, I think, different forecasting going on and different scenarios about how severe the economic downturn is going to be and how long it's going to last. And all of that will impact the state's finances. So one thing is that we approach this knowing that there's a lot of moving parts still, and we really don't have perfect information to be able to accurately forecast exactly what's going to happen to the state's finances. And so what we did is we looked at kind of several different scenarios, ranging from kind of a more moderate economic impact to kind of the most severe economic impact, and focusing on how are those different scenarios going to impact the state's three biggest sources of revenue, which are the personal and corporate income tax and the state sales tax. Combined, those three taxes account for almost half of the state's total revenue. So we really just focused on looking at those three under a range of different scenarios and seeing how might the revenue shortfalls be to those three.
And so what are the range of possibilities? I mean, what's best case to worst case scenarios there?
So when we were looking at it, kind of the low severity and having a kind of quick recovery, we modeled out that might be a loss of about $4 billion. And then the very kind of high range was the most severe pandemic and having a very protracted downturn and weak recovery, meaning that it lasts for several years. And in that scenario, we estimated that it might result in over $28 billion in lost revenue. But I think, you know, the thing that's important for people to keep in mind is these are just estimates, and they're estimates with imperfect information.
Can you put that in context? What would a $4 billion best case scenario revenue hit? I mean, I think those are big numbers. People don't necessarily have a concept of what that means. What does $4 billion get you when you're trying to run a state government?
Right. So we can talk just looking at, so the state's budget is comprised of lots of different funds. People generally talk about it in terms of the general fund, because that's the most, that's kind of the biggest catch-all, and it's where a lot of the discretion is for lawmakers. So the general fund for 2019, to provide some context, was about $40 billion. So you can think, you know, what a $4 billion hole means for a $40 billion budget. The one thing to keep in mind with our estimates is that kind of the biggest financial impact from the most severe pandemic, that's a loss over a couple of years. So it's not, we weren't estimating that the state would lose $28 billion in 1 year.
Okay. Well, that's, I guess, something of a relief. You know, one of the ways I often think about this is that the Illinois prison system, I think the annual budget, and I might be a couple of years old on this, but it's about $1.5 billion. So, I mean, if you think that that's what it costs to run the state prisons, every prison guard's salary, every meal, every, you know, television or gym equipment or whatever that goes into running the prisons is $1.5 billion. And you're talking about, in a best case scenario, well more than double that. So this is, I mean, this would be a significant loss.
Yep, it's a significant loss. Another area of the budget that listeners will probably be familiar with is education. So the pre-K through 12 education is about $8 billion. You know, so they want to kind of think about it in that way too. Potentially, you know, we're talking about a chunk of money that's what the state provides for pre-K through 12 education each year.
We talked about what the potential revenue losses are for the state, but there's also this question of increased spending. And earlier in the program, we spoke with Controller Susana Mendoza, who says Illinois has already spent an unexpected $174 million. And that's just on buying personal protective equipment during the pandemic. It doesn't account for increased medical costs for people in state health programs or labor costs for overtime at the Department of Public Health or Department of Employment Security, other expenses. Do you have a sense of how much extra money Illinois might have to spend to deal with COVID-19?
I think, you know, it's a really good issue to raise, because the pandemic it's impacting revenue and creating this shortfall in collections. At the same time, it's creating a demand for more state services and a great need for it. So in our report, we looked at just kind of three areas of the state budget: public health spending, Medicaid, and human services. And we had some kind of different scenarios in it. We didn't have the same kind of estimates that we did for revenue losses. But one thing that we looked at with Medicaid is we looked at how did Medicaid spending change in the last recession, in the 2007-2009 recession. And we found that during that period, Medicaid spending increased by more than 20%. Right. So if we want to think about Medicaid, which again is just one aspect of the state budget, potentially we're going to see spending increasing by 20% or more.
That's huge, right? I mean, that is a huge amount of money.
It's a substantial amount of money, especially when we're talking about it in the context of this other fiscal pressure of very sharp and significant revenue decline.
Your report also looked at the state pension systems. How healthy were the state pension systems? And I'm sort of holding back a laugh as I ask you this question, but how healthy were the state pensions heading into the pandemic?
Yeah, I feel a little bit like I'm just bringing doomsday news to your listeners, but the state pension systems were significantly underfunded. Illinois kind of frequently gets headlines about how underfunded its pension systems were. So collectively, the five state pension systems were about 40% funded going into this COVID-19 pandemic. So that means that for every $1 in a pension benefit liability, the state has 40 cents in the bank right now. One thing that's important to keep in mind, though, is that those benefits don't all get paid out at once. It's benefits for people that are currently retired, but also people that aren't going to be retiring for another, you know, 10, 20, 30 years. But that being said, the systems were significantly underfunded, and the state's annual payments into the pension systems are a function of their funding level, meaning that the worse funded the pension systems are, the higher the state contributions are going to be.
And we have experience with a major economic downturn from the Great Recession 10 years ago, right? Do we have a sense of whether this will be better or worse than it was back then?
It's a little hard to know because, you know, I think we're still in the kind of economic shock or downturn of the COVID-19 pandemic, and we don't know what the recovery will look like. But part of the problem for Illinois is that the pension system's financial condition did decrease significantly in the wake of the last recession, and it really never recovered. So the pension systems prior to the Great Recession were at about 62% funded, and they dropped down to a low of 39% funded. And they've really just hovered at around 40% funded since that low. So even though the Great Recession was 10 years ago, the state pension systems really haven't seen any financial improvement since the loss in assets that happened from that event.
Well, this is sort of doomsday news, isn't it? Or it doesn't feel like there's a whole lot of positive news to come out of this aspect of this analysis. Robin Fretwell-Wilson, I want to bring you back into the conversation. You are the new director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. From a sort of big picture standpoint, I wonder what concerns you most about the pandemic from a state policy standpoint?
Well, the doomsday place is probably the right place to start, which is I think that the entire unfolding of this has been really difficult for real people's lives in ways that I think have been almost not counted, not able to be counted, because we're so focused on managing a crisis as it unfolds that I think we haven't paused to ask people how those impacts are playing out in their lives. Now, we do that. I mean, good reporting like yours, Brian, does exactly that. But we haven't done it systematically. And I think that's a very important role for IGPA to be playing. You know, we have terrific researchers who have been doing community-engaged research as long as I've been a law professor. That's where I came to this from. And, you know, they're so tapped into vulnerable communities that I think they can add a lot of perspective for us about what it means to be managing this crisis in the way that we are. So, for example, in my own work as a law faculty member, I've been very concerned about, you know, the kinds of risks that children experience in families, right, of physical abuse and sexual abuse, emotional abuse. And one thing that, you know, has been reported widely, but we haven't really ferreted out, is the fact that child abuse and neglect reports in the state have plummeted. And it kind of makes sense of that for a second. We know that the risk factors for things like child physical abuse are things like financial strain, isolation, you know, not necessarily being able to be seen outside of the home so that, you know, our neighbors, our communities can't act as monitors. I mean, this is a perfect storm for children to be suffering right now or to be sort of hit with. And we've got to pay attention to that. And that's one thing that I think IGPA, along with the fiscal picture that it's been painting with Amanda in the interview today, along with the work that it's doing on the healthcare workforce and how do we protect them, and we owe that to them because they're doing so much for us. But how do we take care of those folks where we reliably, predictably can say, hey, you know, we're worried that something may be happening, that we don't have our normal tools in the toolkit to use. You know, so when kids go to school, Brian, their teachers see them. You know, where about half the reports for child abuse and neglect come nationally from teachers. And yet we move to Zoom, right? Or some people don't even have the ability to get on the internet for their children to be doing work from home. So who's watching? Who's paying attention to what's happening to those kids? That's a place where IGPA can add value.
Robin Fretwell Wilson is director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. We also spoke with Amanda Cass. She's an affiliate of the Institute and also associate director of the Government Finance Research Center at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Robin and Amanda, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, even though the stay-at-home order has shut down many businesses, it doesn't stop our need for the services they provide. We'll talk with hairstylists and a salon owner about how they're trying to navigate the crisis for themselves and their clients. Just ahead on the 21st, stay with us. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Hair salons are among the many businesses deemed non-essential during the coronavirus pandemic. And while stylists may have halted their operations, our hair keeps growing. At one of his recent afternoon press conferences, Governor J.B. Pritzker acknowledged his own shagginess and toyed with resorting to the Flobee in order to abide by his own stay-at-home order.
Before the Flobee, only a skilled professional could produce a good layered haircut. Tens of thousands have been sold to satisfied customers. Why? Because it really works.
Proper suction is the key to getting great-looking haircuts with no cleanup.
Hard to believe the Flobee never caught on, or at least not widespread. But all joking aside, for stylists, this is about their livelihood. And on the 21st, we've been checking in with businesses around the state to see how they're faring. Today, we're joined by Bernie Koch, founder and co-owner of Appearances Salon and Retreat in Springfield. Also, Tori Eckley, an independent stylist who has a chair at Six Degrees Salon in Champaign. And joining us from the Chicago area is Yamani Blake, founder and CEO of Blooming Crown, which specializes in beauty services for women of color. Bernie, Tori, Yamani, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
So, Bernie, let's start with you. Before the COVID-19 pandemic, what was a typical workday like?
You know, it was a joy. Our job is to make people look good and feel good, and we enjoy our work. So it was just a joy before COVID-19.
And how have things changed since the stay-at-home orders?
Well, March 18th, we closed the salon. When it became clear that it wasn't safe for my staff or for our clients to continue being in business. We did that before the governor shut down the state and put shelter in place. It was a very difficult decision. And since then, it's been kind of grim, but we're looking forward to reopening, and we're planning in great detail the new reality that we're going to be faced when we do reopen.
And is there any aspect of your business that's able to continue at this time, or is it basically all closed down?
We're open on Mondays for a product pickup where customers call in the salon and order their product, whatever they want. We do the shopping for them off of our shelves. We take their information over the phone. They drive up to our front door and we run products out to them. We've done that every Monday since we closed.
Okay. Yamani, your company does natural hairstyle appointments like braids. That can be very time consuming. And I think for most people, you probably have to have a stylist to do that. Have you heard from your clients about difficulties they might have had since they haven't been able to get appointments?
Absolutely. So I have been doing wellness checks with my clients. Typically, when they get a braid hairstyle or some kind of protective style, it lasts for about 4 to 6 weeks. And so I saw actually a lot of them before I had to shut down for COVID-19. So they're doing okay. I think they're getting a little antsy, but we're all, you know, making sure we check in, and I, you know, communicate with them virtually to make sure that they are maintaining their hairstyles the best way that they can.
Yeah. So sort of talking them through that on, you know, Zoom or some other digital means of communication.
Yeah, so we have a Facebook wellness group, and so I typically, like, you know, post questions, like if anybody has anything that they would like to share, but we've been more so focusing on the wellness aspect in the meantime. since I can't, you know, physically be with them, you know, we do, you know, Facebook Live or we do Instagram Live. And sometimes I'll send out a newsletter just to keep them updated on what's going on with me, because I really built a lot of strong relationships with my clients over the last few years.
Sure. And Tori, what about you? I understand you've also had to postpone all in-person appointments.
Yes, when the stay in place actually went into order, you know, we haven't worked at all. I've had a lot of clients reach out, you know, they have outgrowth from their color and what to do with their bangs being too long. So I try to give them some advice of what to do to temporarily kind of tide them over. But it is really difficult economically. I'm like an independent contractor, so I'm self-employed. So as you know, originally there was no unemployment. Now they have some things you can file for, but their systems are overloaded, so you can't really do that. So it's hard because you are paying a fee each week for, in my case, because I am what you call a chair renter. So I'm still paying for the chair rental and losing that money just like a business owner would, but without any income coming in. So it's hard.
And so I understand that you signed up for a grant for self-employed business owners. What was that process like?
It was actually very easy. It took about 15 minutes to do. It's the EIDL, Economic Injury Disaster Loan. So the first $10,000 can be eligible for a grant, and then everything over $10,000 that you might need, it would be a low interest loan. So that you'll see, but you know, at least that is something for now.
Bernie, I wonder. I understand you've had to. Well, let me ask it this way. What sure. conversations did you have with your staff when you had to make the decision to close your salon?
It was the most difficult thing I've ever had to do. We made payroll. We didn't work a full week, but we were still able to make payroll. And then we assisted each of our employees in signing up for unemployment insurance. And I've been in business for myself for 49 years. I've never done anything so depressing in my life.
Wow. And what were those, I mean, to the extent you're willing to talk about it, and I appreciate you sharing that with us, but what were those conversations like?
Well, our staff was just unbelievably appreciative, because the unemployment deal, we got in early. And so we didn't have the problems that people later on did, but they were very appreciative of us helping them go through that process and answering some questions for them as they went through the process. So they were very appreciative. My staff is just unbelievable, unbelievably supportive. We did then, after that week, we applied for PPP, which is a payroll protection plan from the government. And we received funding on that. And we are going to be making our first payroll on this coming Monday. We have enough money for 2 months for four payrolls. And I just announced that to my staff today, and they are over the moon happy.
Yeah. Wow. That's sounds like great news. Yes. We've been talking about the financial aspect of this, but Yamani, your company not only offers styling services, but I think you mentioned earlier sort of a wellness approach to hair care, and you talked about doing these wellness checks online. And I think that, you know, maybe people don't always appreciate the extent to which a salon is not just a place of business and a place for people to earn a living, but it's kind of can create a sense of community, right? I mean, do you feel that relationship with the people you work with?
Absolutely. And I think everybody on this call can kind of relate to being a therapist, an advice giver, just a comforter, because our clients trust us so much. And we create almost like a sanctuary, safe space for our clients, you know, to process their life, and it's really a transformative experience. So I think it's important to continue to incorporate wellness into what we do, because hair isn't just a physical thing, it's a holistic experience that we give. So I think it's really important to keep emphasizing and checking in on our clients, because, you know, it's like you're almost like a brother or a sister, a family member to a lot of folks. And so keeping those relationships up, whether that's, you know, checking in through phone call or email, I think people can really appreciate when a stylist goes that far for their client.
And Tori, what about you? Do you feel like a therapist for some of your clients?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, there's only a few professions that have the license to actually touch people. And, you know, sometimes that's doctors, and then in our field, it's the cosmetology field. So ours is not, you know, it's a relaxing, it's the trust barrier. You know, when you break that and you're able to, you know, touch people and make them feel better and listen to them, it's very powerful, very powerful.
That's so interesting. I'd never thought about that license to actually touch people. That is pretty rare for people that you're not related to. You know, you mentioned to one of our producers that your clients have really stepped up to help. Can you talk a little bit about how they've been able to support your work, even if they can't come to the salon?
You know, it just shows you in times like this, the power of Americans and how they genuinely care about each other and want to take care of each other, especially in our community. I've had several clients reach out and say, and offer, I'm going to prepay for my service for the next time to get you afloat. And so I've had several of them pay me ahead of time for their services. And that actually really helps, because then I'm able to cover some of my rent, cover some of my losses that I'm experiencing each week. And it really will help all small businesses, if you can kind of think about that. If there's any way that we can pay ahead or do something like that for people in our industry, cosmetologists, I mean, it's very helpful, and it keeps them afloat so we don't lose our small businesses. I mean, we cover like half of what is going on as far as employment for Americans. So it's very important. So if you can think about that and reach out to them in any way, I have my clients just call or text me. You can do it on Facebook, you know, contacting me through Six Degree Salon on Facebook or through Tori Eckley. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's helpful. Very helpful.
But Bernie, I want to ask you, since the stay-at-home orders and closures of salons, the CEO of Walmart, Doug McMillon, says for sales for hair dye and trimmers have ticked up, and it seems like some people have started taking matters into their own hands by cutting or dyeing their own hair. In just a couple of minutes we have left, Bernie, how do you feel about that?
Oh, you know what? Any port in a storm, we can fix anything. So whatever you mess up, we can fix. I've lived through the Flobee. And I fixed an awful lot of Flobee haircuts, and there have been other gizmos to try and get people to cut their own hair, and they're all repairable. Hair grows a half inch a month. When I get calls now about, it's getting horrible, I need a haircut, I tell them, you know what? I don't know of anybody that's died of long hair.
Yamani, I wonder, what about you? Do you have any clients saying that they might need to take things into their own hands, and how do you feel about that?
Yes. So, a lot of my clients love YouTube. I try to get them to listen to me versus YouTube, because a lot of people on YouTube are not licensed and they don't really know like best practices for taking care of hair. So they do what they can. And, you know, of course, like I try to guide them the best way that I can, but I just really am coaching them to like, please just be patient and let's work together while we can't see each other, so that, you know, by the time I see you again, we don't have to like start from square one, because I've walked with them through a lot of different journeys. And I think we can fix anything, but if we can prevent things from happening, that would also be great.
So patience is the key, it sounds like. Yes. Here. Yeah. All right. Yamani Blake is the founder and CEO of Blooming Crown, a natural hairstyle and lifestyle company based in the Chicago area. We also spoke with Bernie Koch, the co-owner of Appearances Salon and Retreat in Springfield, and Tori Eckley. She's an independent stylist at Six Degrees Salon in Champaign. Thank you all so much for speaking with us and sharing your stories with us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You can stay up to date with the 21st on Twitter. You can find us there at 21ST Show. You can also find us on Facebook at the 21st, or you can just send us an email. We'd love to hear what you thought about today's show or anything else, or if you have any suggestions for things you'd like us to talk about. You can send an email, talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. You can also find us everywhere you subscribe to your podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and NPR One. Just search for The 21st. Our program is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Eunice Alpison is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Mackey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.